All right, let's move to agenda item 14. Mr. Harris, would you introduce the item?
Agenda item 14 is a presentation by Chris Kerrigan, the Director of Office of Enforcement at the State Water Board. Welcome, Chris. Thank you for coming down.
Thanks, Ken. Can someone help me turn the screen on, please?
By the way, out of curiosity, Chris, before you start, where are things with the South County Sanitation District petition?
You want to answer that one, Jessica?
we'll be the ones responding to it, not
right.
The Office of Enforcement. And State Board has it. They have not sent out a 30-day letter. ACLs and enforcement actions are kind of lower on their list of things to get to, so I don't know when they'll get to it.
Okay.
I will offer you this, and I'm sure that the Office of Chief Counsel is not aware that I plan to be sending the office a list of enforcement actions that they should pass to Superior Court on, and this is on the list. My recommendation is that the board's findings here are sufficient to protect all the state's interests, completely supported by the record evidence, and there's no reason to wait for years and years for them to resolve what is essentially a straightforward penalty action. So, and we have $11 million in penalties that are basically not being remitted because the dischargers understand that if they petition for review, judgment day will be delayed potentially indefinitely. So we will be urging the Office of Chief Counsel to expedite processing of this matter and other matters where it's essentially an administrative civil liability complaint with a very complete and thorough record. So that's something that's in the works now, and we've just assessed the list and prepared it, so I'll be presenting a letter to Mr. Lauper.
Chris.
By the way, okay, go ahead, Ken. Sorry.
Just to follow up, how does that process work? I mean, do they issue a letter saying it has no merit and that completes the administrative process, or is there a separate one that I have not heard of before in terms of deferring it to the court?
The state board can say that they're not going to accept the petition for review, and then that will trigger the 30-day time limit to file an action in Superior Court. Okay. Past practice has been that they don't do that. So what we're going to try to do, and there are many, many petitions that raise statewide issues where the state board weighing in on them and considering them is an important thing to do. And certainly those things need to take the time that they need to take to queue up with consistent with staff's workload and the importance of the issue. And not that this is not an important case. It is an important case. It just doesn't present any novel issues. Mm-hmm. The record is thorough and well-developed, and the findings are supported by substantial evidence. So
if the state board issues that 30-day letter, and they in the 30 days they don't file a – or in general?
Well, no, it's not a 30-day letter. That's a different thing. The 30-day letter essentially starts the time clock and says they're reviewing it, we'd have to do a response.
Okay.
If they're basically dismissing the petition altogether, then that starts a different 30-day statutory clock for them to file.
And if they don't file in court,
then the regional board's order becomes final.
And how do we get them to pay us if they are reluctant to do so at that point?
It's another question. That's for right now, Darren Palhemas and the Department of Financial Assistance is working on ways for us to collect on bad debt. And you've heard some of that come about, bad debt or current debt. So we're putting processes and protocols in place that should be capable of bringing our sort of accounting procedures more modern and up to date. And so part of that's using collection agencies, making demands, other types of typical actions. We can pursue a judicial action wherein we would perfect the debt as a judgment against the agency and then leverage on the judgment.
Hmm.
So, I mean, that's how I would do it. But again, Jessica is the and the Office of Chief Counsel will be representing the board, and we'll consult with them as we prepare the board's response.
We surely don't want to own the facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Jeffries, and we'll be very conscious about that as we proceed. We'll be very careful about how we proceed with collecting on the judgment. So I'm Chris Kerrigan. I'm the director of the Office of Enforcement. Good afternoon, Chairman Young and honorable board members, Executive Officer Harris. It's a pleasure to address you today in this capacity as Office of Enforcement's director. I have addressed the board in previous occasions as a prosecutor from the Office of Enforcement. I had been a senior prosecutor for about 3 years before becoming the director about a year and a half ago. I'm going to speak to you today about the water quality enforcement policy, about the supplemental environmental project policy. Both of these policies are 2 to 3 years old, and really we're just now gathering enough data to be able to give feedback on how the policies are performing. I'll give you some information about how our SEP policy has been working and some trends under the SEP policy. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about three initiatives that Office of Enforcement is engaged in supporting your staff in the region here and the regions in part. First will be the Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Prevention Unit and their efforts, and then we'll talk a little bit about the sanitary sewer overflow permit efforts that we've been making, and then we'll also talk about the nitrate replacement water order efforts that we've been making. So a little bit of background about Office of Enforcement. It is a separate legal unit in the state board. We have 10 attorneys in the legal unit. We also have a special investigations unit that consists of water resources control engineers and geologists and environmental scientists. We also have a UST unit that deals with underground storage tanks and enforcement. And then we have the new Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Prevention Unit that's recently been made a permanent part of our office. And it was a pilot project designed to root out fraud against the UST fund. Let's see here. This is the legislative mandate that we operate under. It's contained in Section 13,000 of the Water Code, and essentially it says the state must be prepared to exercise its full power and jurisdiction to protect the quality of waters in the state from degradation. And as you know, that, along with attaining the highest water quality that is reasonable, are the two things that the Water Boards does. What we really say in our mission statement is our job is to protect and enhance the water of the state, the quality of the waters of the state. And to do this, we use the tools like policies and programs and permits, one of the most important of which are permits. And enforcement comes into play when their activities take place without a permit, or in violation of a permit. And that's when my office is engaged. We also work with the board with some of its other tools for enforcement, such as cleanup and abatement orders, cease and desist orders, and time schedule orders, all of which come under the rubric of enforcement in one way or another. The enforcement policy is basically guidance on how to use the various tools that we have in a consistent way. The enforcement policy goals are to provide enforcement that is timely, consistent, fair and reasonable, and transparent and repeatable. The enforcement policy went through a rulemaking process, and it essentially has the force and effect of a regulation because of that. It was adopted, approved by the AOL, Office of Administrative Law, in May of 2010. One thing I want to mention here, timely enforcement is very important, but there's a lot of tension sometimes between prioritizing enforcement and getting an action timely before the board. It's sometimes something that can be difficult to balance,
But we work very closely at the Office of Enforcement with your enforcement staff, led by Michael Thomas and Harvey Packard, to help them with prioritizing cases that need to be prosecuted either by way of settlement, cleanup orders, or actions before the board. I have an Office of Enforcement attorney who assists the region with prioritizing cases and helps with legal advice, but your staff are the decision makers on prioritizing cases. The other thing I wanted to mention here is on fair and reasonable enforcement. We have a notion in enforcement that's called progressive enforcement, and essentially what that means is, in practice, your staff may be going to the discharger advising them verbally how to come into compliance and what they need to do to correct violations. And if that doesn't work, we may issue a notice of violation, spelling out specifically what needs to be done and reciting what kind of penalty they might be subject to if they're unable to achieve that. And then finally, if they're still unable to achieve compliance, we may issue an administrative civil liability complaint. And that's the ordinary way that we do business with most dischargers. There are situations when we don't engage in progressive enforcement, and those are situations where we have a high impact to beneficial uses, a very acute or severe impact to beneficial uses, or we have intentional misconduct, which we often deem inappropriate to engage in progressive enforcement if someone is intentionally flouting the law. So in those situations, we wouldn't engage in progressive enforcement, but basically most good faith actors, they're going to get several chances to do the right thing before they face a penalty from your office. The enforcement policy provides processes, procedures, and guidelines for implementing the policy in a way that allows staff to expend limited resources to openly address the greatest needs. That's our prioritization piece. We also want to try to deter harmful conduct, to provide incentives for people to comply, but disincentives for noncompliance, make sure we're protecting the public, and then always trying to achieve maximum water quality benefits. This is the way we achieve the statutory mandates. I wanted to mention a little bit about separation of functions. Essentially, it's a concept related to due process. It is something that indicates that the persons who are prosecuting an action should be separate from those who are advising the board in an adjudicatory proceeding. So when someone's going to be fined or penalized, or potentially in a cleanup action, cleanup and abatement order, where it's in a contested adjudicatory proceeding, you would have different roles for staff, and my office will represent your staff. And one thing I want to make sure you understand there, too, your staff is the decision makers. We have an attorney assigned to your staff, and we have an attorney-client relationship in a specific case, the Office of Enforcement does, with your staff members. And so when we represent the regional board in a specific enforcement action, we are not acting on behalf of the state board. We are acting on behalf of Mr. Thomas and Mr. Packard as the representatives of this office. That's the way we look at our role in enforcement proceedings at Office of Enforcement. So we take our direction from your staff people. The way we usually do business is through stipulated orders or settlements. You probably see quite a few of these come through on consent or with very few comments, normally with good faith actors, which most of your dischargers are. We're able to reach an agreement on most of the points and reach a compromise, and you see those come forward before you. They are negotiated consistent with the penalty methodology. So we use the same methodology that you would apply in adjudicatory proceeding. Mr. Thomas and Mr. Packard, again, the decision maker is the regional board's AEO. These stipulated orders or settlements memorialize a discharger's obligation to pay the fine and also to do work to come into compliance with the permit, and then also to maybe perform a supplemental environmental project or a compliance action. So The reason we try to memorialize these as orders is because they are enforceable immediately by the board. So when we present a settlement agreement to you, we ask you to adopt an order either on consent or after a hearing, so that all of the obligations of the dischargers are memorialized in an order. We consider that to be best practices. When you see this type of settlement agreement and proposed order, frequently there will be no admission of liability by the other party, and they will be waiving their right to a hearing before you. The agreement that you see is between Mr. Thomas and your enforcement staff and the discharger, and it becomes a regional board order upon adoption by the regional board, or in the case where the executive officer has delegated authority and wants to take action, that person can make the order a final order. You should also recognize that when you see one of these items, if people come up at the public comment and they want to take a settlement off consent and they make public comments about the matter, then it doesn't necessarily go on consent, just as an action this morning on a permit was taken off the consent calendar. So you may see this on consent, or it may be agendized for a hearing. If it becomes controversial at the last minute, you'll always have the opportunity to weigh in on the terms of the settlement and put your own thumbprint or fingerprint on it, as you are the decision makers ultimately for any orders that are entered from this by this board. So essentially, that's an overview of the enforcement policy. I want to talk a little bit about the goals of our SEP policy. The SEP policy is something that came out of an audit of the state and regional board's use of supplemental environmental projects. They had a series of recommendations that were made, and this was a response to the recommendations on how to basically attain more accountability in our SEP program. So the goals of the SEP policy are to ensure proper use of the SEP funds. We also limit SEPs to 50% of the total liability, and we want to increase accountability for the allocation and use of funds and enhance public reporting, basically make these projects transparent, whether they're completed and what they really are. And we want to prevent the use of accounts not authorized by statute or the water board. And then we want to also ensure that dischargers cover oversight costs. And this was one of the major findings of the audit, was that we were spending a lot of staff time and money trying to track oversight of SEPs, and that we were not recovering money, and that money was having to come out of general funds, which is not possible anymore since all we have is permit fees. So these are the goals of the SEP policy. And one thing that was a way to implement the goals was to develop criteria for SEP selection. And the way we did that was we made a specific requirement that a SEP must directly benefit or study surface water or groundwater quantity or quality. And it seems like a no-brainer that that's what a SEP would have to do. But when we did look through the audit findings and we looked at some of the SEPs that were approved, it was pretty surprising some of the projects and how little merit they had with respect to water quality. So this is an important qualifier or criteria for getting a SEP approved. And then, of course, the legal requirement for a SEP is it has to be something that the discharger is not otherwise obligated to do to come into compliance. And then, of course, there's the prohibition on financial benefit to water board staff members or employees. A big key, too, is the nexus requirement. Essentially, there must be a nexus or a relationship between the nature or location of the violation and the nature or location of the proposed SEP. And if you interpret these phrases in the disjunctive, it's a very broad phrase. You can really move the SEP money around in a lot of beneficial ways, but you have to be able to make that link to the nature of the violation or the location and the nature of the SEP. And I look at that provision pretty broadly when we're assessing SEPs. The SEP approval process is similar to, or it's included within The settlement approval process that your board engages in, first of all, your prosecution team, which again is led by your decision makers here at the board, and our staff vets the set proposal and then presents it to the board for approval, either in a stipulated order or maybe in a contested proceeding. There's always an opportunity for public comment on the SEP, and then the final step is that the SEP is approved, maybe on consent or after a public hearing. So essentially, we found that increasing accountability under the SEP policy has prevented a lot of solutions in terms of getting beneficial projects and high-value projects, but it also has presented some obstacles and hurdles, and especially in terms of administrative process and tasks. First of all, a SEP is treated as a suspended liability, which means if it is not completed, the discharger is on the hook for the total amount of the fine. So if they go out and fund 50% of a project and the third party who's supposed to be doing the work then fails to complete it, the discharger is responsible or liable for 100% of the suspended liability. And the result of this has been that responsible parties who are risk-averse are reluctant to fund potentially risky third parties in the effort to fund a SEP. But what we've really found out, which I'll show you on the next slide, is it means that high-value, high-dollar SEP projects get funded because they're low-risk. And so it's really led to this, and the other components of this have really led to more money staying in the regions and more money being allocated to higher-dollar value SEP projects. And I do want to say that you know, we have a bunch of different administrative processes. We require a scope of work to be submitted, a budget. We require performance standards for the ultimate project, quarterly reporting on progress so that people aren't falling too far behind on their schedule, in their time schedule for completion. And then we have the project verification requirements under penalty of perjury when the project is completed. All of these things tend to create more burdens on staff, despite the fact that they satisfy the Legislative Accounting Office that we're using the SEP funds in a proper and appropriate way. So what to do about that? And I think here, Region 3 is way ahead of the game, the Central Coast region here, and we at Office of Enforcement have promoted the model that you use here for your two board-approved SEPs, and we're gaining a lot of traction for that model for several reasons. The first is the board members I've talked to in the other boards, they love the idea of being able to direct the SEP money to projects that are of high value to them, to the board members. And instead of reacting to proposals, they're able to be proactive about what types of things need funding in their specific region. So most board members really like that approach. The second is it provides very clear direction to staff on how and what types of SEPs will be accepted. So there's not a lot of vetting of half-baked proposals. Essentially, if you want to participate in a SEP, you have clear direction on how to get it done, both to the discharger and the staff. And to that end, it also minimizes the administrative costs on staff in terms of tracking SEPs and all of the various milestones and different components of them. So it's very efficient with respect to the use of staff time. And then, as we'll see in just a second here, because these pre-approved board SEPs present low risk to dischargers, risk-averse dischargers are willing to fund them even with the suspended penalty or suspended liability component. So in Region 2 recently, we've built a project similar to what you guys have been doing here for years in Region 3. And even got Chevron, who's one of the most risk-averse of dischargers out there, to participate in that particular SEP with a nice chunk of funding for an entire milestone of that project. And they just want to cash out and be done. So it was very unusual to see them take that approach. And I think that's part of this notion that if you have something that's reasonably or fairly certain that it's going to be performed through a legitimate and reputable entity with a track record, then even risk-averse public companies are willing to participate in that kind of funding. So most of the other board members where I've worked through this with them now, or boards, are in the process of following the track that Region 3 has blazed with respect to the creation of these the two SEPs that you have board authorized in this region. This is the statistics for the state board projects, and what you can see here on the left, these are the 2 years prior to the effective date of the SEP policy, years 2007 and 2008. Statewide, the amount of money going into the SEPs in those 2 years was $10 million and $8 million approximately, respectively, and that the number of projects there were above 40 or above in each of those years. I dropped 2009 and 10 because the policy applied to some enforcement actions, but not all, during those 2 years as we were working matters through the project. And then I looked at years 2011 and 12, and what you can see is more money is staying in the regions in set projects than it had in years past, and the number of projects is going down. So we like to see the trend in terms of keeping the funding there in the regions for these high-value, high-dollar SEPs on the increase. And I'll also tell you that I made a presentation on SEPs to the State Board 2 months ago, and the State Board members asked us, Office of Enforcement and DFA, Department of Financial Assistance, to prepare not necessarily a report, but to compile data on SEP projects and cleanup and abatement count projects in the same area so that the public can see how penalty money and that's gained from enforcement action is actually being used to benefit water quality across the state. What are the types of projects that you're funding in your region and in the other regions, and what are the type of the projects that the state is using their split of the penalty money to fund? So that'll be interesting, and we should have that prepared at the end of this next fiscal year when we do our report. We do a SEP report every year, but we've never combined it with DFA's cleanup and abatement account report. So we'll be working jointly on that project for next year. Little bit about the penalty methodology goals. And here, a couple critical things. First, we want it to be fair, consistent, and transparent. Consistency is very important. That's a problem the enforcement policy was designed really to resolve. Consistency over time and also across geographic boundaries, and that's what we seek. A really important aspect of the penalty methodology is to make sure that economic and competitive advantage is not obtained from noncompliance. If you're getting a monetary benefit from committing violations, what you're really doing is punishing those who would voluntarily comply. And, you know, that's really important to avoid that effort when you're engaged in enforcement. So that's one of the things we're looking at, and, of course, that's the notion of deterrence of future violations. Really want to make sure that the amount of a civil liability is enough to encourage compliance and deter future noncompliance. And that basically also includes, pardon me, a notion of how likely it is that you're going to get caught. If a lot of people are getting away with noncompliance, a penalty needs to have a premium on it, because that way, if you do get caught, it's a very severe type violation. But you'll see, and I think you did see when you applied the factors in the South San Luis Obispo matter, how the penalty policy or methodology works. Essentially, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail like I would with some of the other boards who are newbies with this penalty policy, because I'm sure you can tell me about the various nuances for the various factors after living through that proceeding. And I do want to thank the board. It did an incredible job with managing that matter. And again, after reviewing the order and the transcripts, all of the findings are evidence supported. The conclusion is clear from the findings, and this is the way the policy is supposed to work.
each of the factors comes
Chris,
from...
Chris, can I interrupt you for a second?
Absolutely. Anyone can feel free to interrupt me. Go ahead.
Do we win the prize for the latest meeting? I'm just curious if other...
The latest meeting for some... No, I think Lori Oaken had an example of another meeting, but I'm not sure that we could verify that there was actually a later meeting. But you do win the prize in my book for best result from latest meeting. right. Each of the factors that you assessed in that case and in the penalty methodology come right out of the statute. So what the enforcement policy did was it took the factors that are enumerated in the statute and put them together in a way that makes a consistent methodology or consistent way of approaching various or any type of violation, basically. It's how to consider the various factors that are set forth in the statute. Each factor is considered independently, and the board makes evidence-supported findings based on all the factors, and then assesses the factors to reach an ultimate conclusion. And what they call that in legal parlance is tracing the analytical route from evidence to finding to result. And that's what we're required to do in administrative proceedings. But I think when you go through the various exercises and reach a conclusion or a result, you can really see, the public can really trace the board's thinking from what happened to why there's a penalty and how much it was. And so I show this for the engineers in the audience. For me, I like the text. I can follow the text. But really, if you look at this flow chart, it basically describes the process that you go through and how we crafted, or the enforcement policy created, the method for applying the statutory factors. And you just basically go through the steps. It's a handy flow chart for tracking where we have disputes. A lot of times when your staff and my attorneys are negotiating a penalty action, we may be looking at this, we may only disagree on one or two of the factors. The rest of it, we may not have disagreement. And so we can isolate those two things and figure out how potentially to bridge the gap between the discharger's point of view and the staff's point of view. Then when they come to the hearing, everything's disputed. So that's what I wanted to say about the enforcement policy and the SEP policy, and then also the penalty methodology. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about some of our current initiatives. Recently, we've been focused on several fraud, waste, and abuse prevention cases, one of which involves a consultant that primarily worked out of this region from Santa Barbara and Ventura counties, essentially. His name is Kurt Hayden. He is the principal of Hayden Environmental, Inc. This is the first case that our fraud, waste, and abuse unit of staff at the Office of Enforcement investigated and referred to the Attorney General's office. Mr. Hayden, on June 14th, will be entering a plea of guilty to felony fraud in the Santa Barbara Superior Court for defrauding the UST fund, submitting false claims to the UST fund. He has agreed to serve 6 months in jail for his misconduct and reimburse the state for $1.6 million in restitution for his frauds. He will also give up his geology licenses and other professional licenses for at least 3 years, and he will agree to do no more work for the fund and submit no more invoices to the fund. So this is what we call case number one. It was one involving a fairly mid to low-level consultant, and it's what we consider to be a very successful prosecution through the Attorney General's office. We have three more cases pending with the Attorney General's office now. In two of the cases, search warrants have been executed. We expect that these other cases will also be very significant. Importantly, we have developed with the fund staff new protocols for detecting fraud in advance of paying invoices, which is always helpful. You don't throw someone in jail, but you're at least not giving out the state's money improperly. So we've been working very closely with the fund staff to develop new protocols, and fortunately for the regulated public,
It's not taking any more time than it has historically to process invoices through the fund. So this is something where we work with regional board staff to some extent, but it's mainly our investigators at the in the Fraud, Waste, and Abuse Prevention Unit that do this. One side benefit is we have detected several cases of lab fraud for labs that are submitting compliance data for our MPDS program. And unfortunately, they are ELAP certified through Department of Public Health. The Department of Public Health has the authority to take enforcement action against these parties, not us. But we have presented cases with evidence and allegations and citations to their authority to them. So we are hoping that they will just pick those up and run with them, given the somewhat tenuous situation DPH is in right now with respect to the legislature. So in any event, one thing that we found out, and of course, as you may know, if we get bad compliance data from a discharger, then we can't take enforcement action because our evidence is tainted. It's not good. So we need really to rely on independent lab analysis for our compliance data. So that's one thing we've been working on. The second thing I wanted to report on is we've been doing assisting the regions, primarily providing technical backup and legal support on enforcement actions for sewer spills over 50,000 gallons. South San Luis Obispo was one of those cases that we supported this region on. We have several others pending in this region and around the state right now. So we want to make sure that if we have 50,000 gallons or more of sewage reaching surface waters, that some type of appropriate enforcement response is being made. And despite the difficulty with regional boards being able to prioritize staff, I think we've been very successful at being able to backfill behind regional board staffs and not interrupting their other prioritization processes and priority enforcement actions. Of course, we don't want to divert any resources away from the ag issues in this region, so we've been able to backfill with some staff support behind your excellent staff here in the region. And then the last thing I want to talk about is replacement water orders for nitrate-impacted groundwater. And I really enjoyed the opportunity to listen to the discussion from the board this morning during your board members' reports and then also from the food and ag representatives from the state about nitrate and impacted groundwater and the various tools that we have at our disposal. The state board's recommendations addressing nitrate and groundwater to the report to the legislature came out a few months ago, and in that report it says that the state board and the regional boards will use their existing authority under Water Code Section 13304 to issue replacement water orders to provide replacement water in appropriate circumstances. And I want to emphasize that this is a limited tool that has considerable limitations. It's only a piece of the puzzle, but there's no reason that enforcement can't be participating and part of this process to encourage those actors who would try to gain a benefit through noncompliance to come up with the rest of those who want to comply and protect groundwater quality. So there is a role for enforcement. I will say that I consider these replacement water orders under Section 13304 cleanup and abatement orders light, because at this time we are not in any way looking to compel responsible parties to clean up the groundwater. What we're looking for here is to stem the tide of acute water quality issues relating to drinking water impacts, and especially to environmental justice communities and ag communities. So we're not looking to issue cleanup orders. That's not our directive. What we're looking to do is issue orders and otherwise convince, persuade, and cajole those who are in a position to provide replacement water to those who would otherwise be drinking nitrate-affected drinking water. And so With that in mind, there are some constraints with issuing orders under 13304. The standard is that the party who is subject to the order must have caused or contributed to a condition of pollution or nuisance. Well, the condition of pollution or nuisance part is easy if you have nitrates in excess of the MCL. The problem is whether they were caused or contributed to that condition. And so you may have issues with continuity of operation. If it's been a long time and it's been the same operation, that may present a viable case. But if there have been many operators and many owners over time, that makes the case more difficult in terms of what's their contribution to the contamination at the site. Also, it's very dependent in cases on the local hydrogeology. How many folks are contributing to that groundwater basin? What's the speed or movement of the water? And what's the depth of the vadose zone? How long does it take contaminants to reach the groundwater? So all of those things come into play. As you know, there has to be substantial evidence to support a cleanup order. And so one thing that's important to have evidence to support is the fact that the responsible party did cause or contribute to the condition of pollution or nuisance. That being said, there are situations out there that we can identify, and that I'm working with Mr. Thomas, Mr. Packard, and the rest of your staff to try to identify situations where we can work with landowners to help provide suitable potable drinking water for those who are otherwise impacted. We'll need different tools to address legacy contamination. And if you've read the State Board's nitrate report, and I know you guys are on the front lines of this issue, there are some real challenges ahead of us with respect to trying to address the legacy issues. We saw the presentation earlier today about how to stop the degradation and to reverse degradation of groundwater, but we're still going to have those legacy issues that are ultimately going to need to be resolved. So consistent with Dr. Hunter's comments this morning about the SRF money being available potentially and maybe DWR money, there's also probably going to be some money from responsible parties, and we'll take care of that side with the assistance of your staff. And I have seen some of their outreach to the regulated public and the affected communities here, and they're really out ahead on some of those issues. Just to kind of round out the topic, I wanted to mention that, as Mr. Harris and Chair Young mentioned, during the presentation earlier today, we can use these studies and this information about agronomic rates to set standards that parties should be engaged in and should be using. And if those parties are using those and we're reducing the impacts to groundwater and preventing nitrate or nitrogen from seeping through the vadose zone below the root zone into the water, and we're bringing up the farming community to the point where we're achieving positive results there, there's a role for enforcement for those who won't participate or engage or evolve in a way that others are willing to do. So it's appropriate to set industry standards and best practices so that we can establish who is meeting those types of practices and who is not. So that's what I wanted to present today, and I'd be happy to have answer any questions or engage in any kind of discussion about these topics.
Great presentation and overview, Chris. I don't think we've had one that comprehensive from your office since I've been on the board. Very helpful.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any board questions? Dr. Hunter.
Thank you, Chris, and ditto. So just for in our enforcement report today, and I didn't bring it up, but I'm wondering if you can comment a bit about the Las Colinas Ranch cleanup and abatement order, where this is the first case I've seen where we've had replacement water ordered, and it seems to be agreeable by all the parties. And can you fill us in? Did you play a role in that, and do you always have a role to play with cleanup and abatement where replacement water is involved?
I have a backup role. I did not play a leading role in that matter. It was Mr. Thomas with the assistance of Francis McChesney
who basically took the lead on that. What I will do, though, now is pick the ball up as we move forward with some of the other potential sites. So I was engaged in sort of the back-end negotiation after that was the arrangement was almost the fait accompli.
Yeah, I didn't, as I said, I didn't pursue it, but I hope we hear some progress reports on that so we understand what these mechanisms are, as I suspect there may be more data and more ways in which we can start to isolate these small, especially disadvantaged community component of this.
Yeah, we're working with that, trying to accomplish that, and I've reached out to some of the Clean Water Coalition folks and that are active in this region and in the Central Valley, and I have been engaged with Region 6 Board, actually, in the southern Mojave area. I didn't realize there's so much dairy farming going on there, but they have probably half a dozen replacement water orders that are based on nitrate coming out of their region. So trying to coordinate and be consistent, working in different areas, and working on making sure we're getting clean, safe drinking water in these ag communities.
Mr. Thomas.
I just wanted to respond to Dr. Hunter's question about a status report. And I did issue this order for San Lucas requiring replacement water in March, the initial order. And after getting comments back from the responsible parties, I revised the order and reissued it in April. And as a result of those revisions, the responsible parties agreed to not petition the order to the State Board. And they had been in agreement with us all along in the discussions that we were having with them for several months that they would provide replacement water to the community of San Lucas, which is about 300 to 450 people, depending on the season. And the credit for that outcome goes to Hector Hernandez, who's in the audience today, our staff, who worked with the responsible parties and collaborated with them very closely on coming up with a solution to the problem. And it does require short-term and long-term replacement. So this is an ongoing issue, and we will be bringing reports back to the board. Hector and I went to San Lucas last week and met with the community. And what we found out is that an order like this requiring replacement water is just the first step. It doesn't solve the problem. And we realize that the challenges that the community faces are extraordinary. And the process of providing replacement water itself provides a challenge for the community and is an impact on the community. Imagine where you used to just turn on your faucet and you get water, clean water coming out. And then that's no longer the case for them now. They reported to us that sometimes the water comes out black, sometimes it comes out milky white, and the replacement water was being provided in a way where they did not have access to it. So this community, they're largely farm workers, and so they have very long work days, and often 6 days a week. So they're not present when the delivery truck comes into town. And so we have people that are older, and it's hard for them to get out. They cannot carry 5-gallon jugs. You know, and you have mothers that are taking care of kids. They don't have access to the water. So we learned about the challenges that they face, those physical challenges, and we documented those, and we're now going to work with the community and the responsible parties and the water district to improve and that delivery method and make sure that they get the water in a manner that they can actually use it, they can access it and use it. So those are significant hurdles to overcome in a case like this. And we have other cases that were on the books that we're making a list, a priority list of other cases to investigate and take action on. And Chris will be our lead attorney for those actions if an attorney is necessary. Hopefully we can work with the responsible parties to take action and provide the replacement water. As we look into this more and more, there are many, many areas in our region. And it's surprising to us how many there are, how many enclaves, labor camps, small communities that exist that have this problem. And we're working with environmental justice organizations to find them and get the data and take action on those cases. So we'll be reporting back to you and to the extent that we can provide an overview. We can't go into details on these cases because they are being done under the separation of functions and under Chris's office. And so there's a limit to how much information we can share in terms of investigative work, but we can give you an overview of what we're doing, and we'll definitely do that.
And one couple additional things. I have a specialist in my office that is assigned to work on water replacement orders specifically, and she is compiling a series of modular-type water replacement plans where we can direct people to look at the various plans on our website, the components of the plan, and tailor a water replacement plan to fit the situation that they're affected by. So we want to make sure that we're getting information and getting resources out there from the statewide basis, because we have six examples. Three of them are very different and unique conveyance systems and replacement water systems from around the state. We want to show the different types of replacement water plans that can be implemented and give the responsible parties opportunities and options for the provision of replacement water. So I have a dedicated staff person to that effort and to back up the investigation efforts here in your region.
That is really important, and thank you for letting us see the direction that this is all rolling, because there is a lot of attention. There are several legislative mandates in place, and I know the information that is lacking, you know, in terms of taking action is another component of this, and I think our staff has done some remarkable work in finding small steps that we can take with the resources we do have, and hopefully that will raise attention and elevate the priority, as Michael described it, as we begin to know more about what we haven't seen or understood about our communities in this region. Thank you.
Dr. Wolf, and then Mr. Johnston.
Yeah, and you know, I was going to say that I've been couple of years on, pardon me, on the board, and you know, I'm very encouraged to see how with your group seems to be very well organized and a well-oiled machine. So that's nice to see that. I was going to supplement a comment that my view, aside of the environmental justice issues such as, you know, water replacement, but when we look at bad actors in regard to fraud and willful misconduct, negligence, I think it's also then a matter of fairness and equity for the law-abiding citizens to see that those who willfully violate the law, you know, are paying the consequences. So I think that's an important element of what you do. A question that I have is, since the Water Board is part of EPA, and under EPA, there are other similar agencies. Are some of the other EPA agencies using a similar model to yours for enforcement, or are you very unique on how you operate?
We're very unique in how we operate. I meet now with the other BDOs, DTSC, the Air Board, what used to be the Waste Board, now is called Cal Recycle, and the Department of Pesticide Regulation with Cal EPA to talk about coordinating enforcement efforts and multimedia cases. And that's something that's fairly new. It's been going on for a couple years, but 5 years ago we were all pretty siloed. We also determine who's going to be the lead on a particular case, instead of getting all the way down the road and then getting in a fight with DTSC over who should be the lead at a particular site. Now we coordinate in advance. Someone's the lead. Someone's the consulting agency. But nobody has an enforcement policy. No one's adopted an enforcement policy like we have that provides a sort of transparency and a guidance for the boards to follow. And I think Cal EPA would probably like to promote that model with the BDOs, but we are not necessarily under Cal EPA, although we are organized within that agency. We have a lot of independent authority that comes from the statute that is directly conferred upon the water boards. And so some of that is enforcement related, and we steer our own course. to some extent. I mean, of course, we want to work together with the other BDOs because then we can all leverage our money. And also with U.S. EPA and the other DAs. And so I spend a lot of my time now as a bureaucrat. I'm not that much of a lawyer anymore. I'm more of a bureaucrat. But I spend a lot of my time meeting with other agencies and trying to coordinate our initiatives and enforcement actions with those other agencies so that all of the good enforcers in the regions and at the state are leveraging our resources as much as we can.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnston.
I want to compliment Mr. Thomas and his team on the San Lucas settlement. It was very good, particularly in that the responsible parties have agreed to provide a new well. At the same time, and correct me if I'm wrong, Michael, we shouldn't get too optimistic because it was a particularly rare set of circumstances where it was a very shallow well in the middle of a big field that converted from grapes to green vegetables, and suddenly the nitrates went sky high, and it was actually, you know, finding causation, which is the really difficult thing here. It was a particularly straight up case. You did a great job establishing it, but those are not going to be the rule. They're going to be the exception.
Yes, they will. This case was very straightforward. It was pretty black and white, and we thought we had a really strong case to make. The other cases, I don't want to give the board the impression that they're all going to go this way. They're not. We undoubtedly will have cases where we're going to there'll be a difficult investigation, and that it will be more gray than black and white. We will still pursue those cases, and we'll still take action on those cases. And in other programs in our office, we have the very same situation where we have multiple dischargers, sometimes multiple plumes, multiple landowners, responsible parties, and changes over time, and we take action in those cases. So we will be taking action in these cases too, but they will not go necessarily as well as this one, and we're aware of that.
That was
and
sweet.
It's great to point out that the board should be aware of that too.
I do have a question in terms of you mentioned there's always the ability for public comment on SEP items. And just so I'm clear, now we're a board that has authorized, has delegated to our executive officer the authority to sign off on SEP projects. Do those still have a public comment period if they're not coming before the board?
Yes. If it's an MPDS case, there's a 30-day public comment period required on any settlement that would include a SEP proposal. So stormwater case or any of those. Generally speaking, the EOs put things out for comment, and if they're – I'm not sure if Ken has a practice – yet, or if he plans to develop a practice, or he hopes he doesn't have to. But most of the EO's practice is to allow the 30-day public comment period to expire. Probably they're polling the board members, too. I don't know about that. And then if there are no comments, then they may sign the order. But generally speaking, I haven't seen one where there are comments where it's not brought up before the board for a decision. So,
and settlement agreements, is there public comment on those as well?
It's the same thing because the SEP is part of this, would be part of the settlement agreement and proposed order, right?
Okay, but if there's no SEP in a settlement agreement, then there's no public comment.
No, there still would be a public comment period.
So yeah. The San Lucas case, for example, went through public comment and then revision.
Yes,
it did. I think Michael or Harvey can answer. I think they all are put up on the web or public noticed, right, before you give them to me for signature.
Yes. Thank you. I'm just educating myself here.
Harvey Packard, I'll point out that in some cases, very routine ones where the discharge, like an MMP, will count the 30-day process from.
An MMP is?
A mandatory minimum penalty where they acknowledge they were in there and they have to pay it. Will sometimes count the EPL, the actual the NOV that goes out as the beginning of the 30-day comment period. But and even in those cases, a lot of times they'll sit on the website for 30 days after that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much. I always appreciate the opportunity to address the board.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Okay, folks, we could take a break if you'd like for 10 minutes or so, and then when we resume, we'll go and do agenda item 6 before hitting the EO report.